All right, guys, if you want to be making your way back in, we're going to go ahead and start our last session of the day. So far, so good, I believe. Thank you for everybody being here. We have one more lesson. Eric's going to lead us in that. You are a member of the body is the title of that lesson. And he will extend. You did change it? Okay, so forget everything I just said, except that Eric is going to be the one presenting that lesson. And after that lesson, we will have an invitation song, and then I'll have a couple closing announcements, and then we'll have a prayer before we leave for the social events. But without further ado, I'm just going to turn it over here to Eric.
I was going to talk about being members of the body of Christ and the imagery in 1 Corinthians 12 about different body parts assisting the body, all the lessons that you see there in 1 Corinthians 12. But then Philip said, well, you need to do your stuff that you do with atheists and skeptics. You got to talk about that when you're there. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll do that. Since moving to Atlanta, one of the things that I've started doing with a lot more intentionality than I did in California is have studies with skeptics and atheists. Because I grew up in an agnostic kind of household, I'm comfortable doing that kind of thing, and atheism and skepticism is something that's growing quite a bit, and so I think we've got to think through how to address some of these things. In 2 Peter chapter 2, Peter warns about teachings that come into the church. The idea being that they start in the world somewhere, and they get propagated in the world somewhere, and then they come into the church. Like, kind of like a fully formed, like, child. Like, it's already been formed out there, but then it comes in. And I think it's important to understand why our society is becoming what it's becoming. And none of this is like, oh, we need to go back to the 1950s. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. I want to say some things about where our culture is right now and why that's the case. And maybe some things that could help us is if we start to wonder about the modern skeptical kind of lens, if that's getting into our hearts. But if we've got friends that might be in that same place, I think some of these things might be helpful for us to consider. I want to begin with a little bit of a cultural pulse of what's happening in the United States right now as a way to frame what we're talking about. The statistics that I'm about to show apply to the United States. They don't apply to other countries. And so let me show you a couple things here. The decline of religion in the United States right now, I think it was Pew Research in 2009, they talked about the religiously unaffiliated, which would include atheists, which say that they know there's no God, agnostics who say, I'm not sure and I'm not really going to do a lot of research about this, or people who are just indifferent, people that just don't have any concern about religious matters and things like that. They found that these people, in 2009, it was 17% of the United States. In 2009. This 26% number was done in 2019. So in 2019, these numbers went up quite a bit. But just even since the Rona and all these other things that have happened in the last couple of years, these numbers have jumped up even more. There was another research Gallup poll found now, this was done just a few months ago, that less than 50% of Americans belong to a church now. And the reason stated in that article was they said that the decline in the church membership is primarily a function of the increasing number of Americans who express no religious preference. And so you look at this and you go, well, what is this going to be in another 2 years? What is it going to be in 10 years? Are we going to start looking like the Czech Republic or something like that? I don't know. But let me just, I want to ask this as a discussion question. Why do you guys think that this is happening right now? What are some reasons you can think of? As the ominous storm comes. Yeah. Okay. Like kind of the bend away from religion and things like this, and it's getting influenced very young. Okay, good. What else? Yeah. Right, and my truth and my experience, right? You can't take anything away from my experience, sort of thing. Good, and that kind of reigns supreme. Yeah. In what way? Yeah, very good. In fact, there's actually a book called Faith of the Fatherless by Paul Vitz, and the book argues, it talks about a lot of the most famous atheists from the past, and it shows how a lot of these guys, their father was either non-existent in their life or their father had died when they were young. And not that there's always a direct correlation, but it's an interesting pattern. And so, yeah, that fits into that. I saw your hand over here. Yeah, good. Why would God let COVID happen? There's a lot of people that have gotten really sick from it, things like that. Any other ideas? That's a good one. Yeah, in fact, the churches that water things down are the churches that end up declining more because they don't stand for anything anymore. But people think, well, if we kind of water it down, then we'll get the masses. Maybe for a little while, but that doesn't last super long. So those would be some good reasons to consider. Another reason to add to the mix is that in the early 1900s, there's been this kind of cultural push, really since the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment, by the way, says that human rationality, human understanding will be able to give reasons for things. So the more that we advance scientifically, which science has certainly done a lot of good things, but the more that we advance in these kinds of ways, the less that we're going to need religion anymore. So we live in this society now that say religion is sort of obsolete, because we have come to understand things in a deeper, better way, all of this kind of thing. And so one of the reasons for, I think, this decline is if I want to hold to what the Bible says, what am I going to look like more and more in our society? A dumb dinosaur, right? Like, I'm going back to these old things, but we've advanced so far beyond that. So some of this is going to be peer pressure as well, in addition to all the other things that we just talked about. But one of the things that whenever I study with skeptics, the first thing that I want to try to help them understand in the first session that we have or Bible study group or whatever, is I want them to understand that to reject the Christian worldview and to adopt the secular worldview does not mean that you're forsaking faith. It doesn't mean that, oh, well, you know, I was blindly believing in these Christian ideas, and now that I believe in the modern secular sort of approach to things, does that still require faith? Does it require faith to believe in the Big Bang? Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, but does it require faith to believe in it? Does it require faith to believe that Darwinian evolution has happened and in the way that they say that it's happened? Does all that require some degree of faith? Yeah, it does. And so one worldview to another, both of them are requiring faith. So I think there's something beyond just, well, I've looked at the evidence and I see because of my objectivity that Christianity is not true, because there's still things that are missing with this other worldview as far as objective data goes, or data, whatever. So let me show you a quote from Aldous Huxley. He wrote a book in 1937 called Means and Ends. And he explained, he was an atheist, and he explains one of the motives for his atheism. He said this: the philosopher who finds no meaning in the world, by the way, when he says no meaning in the world, what he means by that is that there's no transcendent God that we have to owe account to. So there, in a sense, it's meaningless, is what he's saying. So he said, the philosopher who finds no meaning in the world is not concerned exclusively with a problem in metaphysics. What's metaphysics? Yeah, spirituality, but what else? Supernatural. So the person that believes that there's no meaning in the world is not just concerned with the problem in metaphysics, he's also concerned to prove that there is no valid reason why he personally should not do as he wants to do. For myself, the philosophy of meaninglessness was essentially an instrument of liberation, sexual and political. So you look at this guy, pretty respected atheist, and he's saying that the reason that he's concerned with this meaningless worldview is what? Yeah, I want to be able to do what I want to do. And by the way, I can sound pretty sophisticated by, like, if I just said, hey, I want to do whatever I want to do sexually or politically or whatever. If I just start with that, I sound pretty unsophisticated, right? So what I can do is I can start looking at all this really cool science and data and all this kind of stuff and throw all these things at you, and I'll look legitimized in my unbelief, right? And I think that's sometimes the appeal to the Richard Dawkins and all these different famous skeptics that people will read from. But even anecdotally, whenever I've studied with skeptics, one of my first questions is, tell me about your religious experience. 9 out of 10 of them is something like this. Oh, my religious experience. So I grew up with really hypocritical parents, and they brought me to church every Sunday. Or another one will go, I grew up in such and such a denomination, and they covered up all the sexual immorality that was happening in it. Ridiculous. So, like, the most emotional I see these people is when I ask them about their religious experience. In other words, the point that I'm making is that your motive for believing in something other than the Christian worldview, you might have the air in this kind of appearance that what you're concerned with is objective facts and data, but there's something else behind it. What's actually started your path towards unbelief is an emotional reaction to the negativity that you experienced in your religion. Anybody have any friends that have left the Lord because mom and dad were hypocrites, or because at church the preaching was always hellfire and brimstone, or something, whatever it was, some negative kind of thing or whatever. By the way, there is a reason why the hellfire and brimstone preaching used to be really prominent. Let me just say this really quick. This is a rabbit hole. But I think younger people need to hear this because I needed to hear this. I did a gospel meeting one time in Indiana, and I had mentioned during the gospel meeting that there's a contrast between preaching today versus preaching in the 1950s and 60s, and I wasn't criticizing one or the other or anything. I was just an observation to make another point that I was making. And there was an old preacher that came up to me afterwards, and he said, well, do you know why it was so much hellfire and brimstone in the 50s and 60s? And I said, no, please tell me why. And he said, it was because after World War II, people had pictures of concentration camps, and people had videos of things. Like, my grandpa broke the gates down at Dachau in Germany. Like, he was there on the front lines. People saw all this kind of stuff, and then people come back from war. Do you suppose people want to know that there's a God that's going to execute justice one day? We've not experienced that kind of thing in our generation. But if we did, would we like more of that hellfire and brimstone, this affirmation that there is a God that's going to hold people accountable? I think we would. That's just a generational point. Anyways, what you see in this is that if the reason people believe in something other than Christianity and they're going towards this secular kind of worldview, oftentimes when I've studied with skeptics, the first thing that I used to do is talk about objective arguments for the faith. Like, here's the arguments for the existence of God. Here's why the Bible is reliable. Here's the archaeological evidence. There's a place for all of that sort of thing. But if I'm giving facts and data to somebody who's not objectively minded, and they're actually, like, reacting emotionally, and here's facts and data, facts and data, facts and data, am I really meeting them where they're at? Do you see the problem? Have you ever known anybody that was a skeptic and you tried to give, like, some book about evidences or something like this, and, like, it did nothing for them? We live in a society that makes more of its decisions based on subjectivity, as one person said already, than we do objective facts and data. In fact, in 2016, Oxford Dictionary, every year they have a word of the year that's supposed to encapsulate some prominent thing about the year. In 2016, the word was post-truth, post-truth. Post-truth means that when people make their decisions about their worldview, about what they're going to do, not with regards to facts and data, but with regards to what subjectively makes the most sense to them. So how do you communicate the gospel in a society like that? What do we do? The argument that I use when I study with skeptics now is, first of all, to help them understand that there's different needs that every human being has. And what we do is we compare, how does the secular worldview give you this need versus the Christian worldview? In other words, which worldview offers the resources that you know you need? Now, in that way, it shows that Christianity fits like a glove, which might point to a creator who knows our psychology, knows what we need. And then you give them the, here's the arguments for the Bible, here's the arguments for all these things, because now you want Christianity to be true. But as long as you don't want it to be true, no facts and data are going to help you. So what you'll understand more of what I'm saying as we go through the rest of this lesson. For the rest of this lesson, I want to talk about five universal human needs and compare the secular worldview to the Christian worldview and just compare which worldview gives you what you need. So the first one is our need for meaning. Everybody would say that they need some kind of sense of meaning in life. And there's two directions to meaning in life. You look back to your origins and you ask, why am I here? And then you look forward and you ask, is what I'm doing going to count forever? Is it going to matter in some way? All right? So what I do, whenever I study with the skeptics, I don't quote the Bible a whole lot. What I've done is I've read from a ton of skeptics and atheists. And I'm clipping quotes that I think are going to be relevant to them. I'm just going to show you just a few of them. But every study we have, it's like a two-sided piece of paper that we use as our discussions from things that skeptics have said. So here's one skeptic, and by the way, okay, so I'll just put this up here and we'll kind of dissect it a little bit. All right, Stephen Jay Gould, in 1988, Life magazine had a... they interviewed a bunch of really famous people, and they said, what's the meaning of life to you? What's the meaning? They interviewed musicians and athletes and whatever, and Stephen Jay Gould is a scientist, and he said this, we are here because one odd group of fishes had a peculiar fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures, because the earth never froze entirely during an ice age. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. This explanation, though superficially troubling, if not terrifying, is ultimately liberating and exhilarating. We must construct these answers for ourselves. Okay. So he affirms on the one hand that there is no objective meaning. How did we get here, according to him? Yeah, the fin, like, kind of like, I don't know how it worked. But the fish got lucky with the right kind of fin or something like this. And he says, so, okay, you're looking for these higher answers. Why are we here? All this kind of stuff. There's no answer to that. No answer exists. But here is the secular approach to finding meaning in life. By the way, secular people, they've got reasons for the things that they believe, right? What is their approach to finding meaning in life? What do you see here? As the storm comes again. Personal experience, yeah. What else? What does he say around here? Yeah. As far as like objective meaning, like creator that we have to answer to, no. There's no ultimate meaning in life. They'll say that. But what they'll say is that doesn't mean I don't have meaning, though. That in my little life that I'll live, I have meaning. And what do you suppose some skeptics and atheists would say their meaning is? Yeah, happiness, what else? How would they get that? Helping others. Yeah, I like to help others. What about family? Like, I want to have a family one day. I want to have a nice house, all this kind of stuff. And they'll say, well, and these things, even though there's not any kind of, like, objective transcendent meaning, this is what gives me meaning in life. All right, what's the problem with this, though? And this is what I do when I study with the skeptics. We say I try to accurately portray their worldview, so I'm not straw-manning it. And they'll say, yeah, like this quote is one of the ones that they really like. That's exactly what I believe. Okay, well, what's the problem with this? That let's say that my meaning in life is my career, or my meaning in life is my family. Let's just start with family. Do I realize that one car accident can take my meaning in life away from me? What if my wife and kids all die in a car accident? My meaning in life has been stripped away. What if my meaning in life is my career, and then somebody goes back on something I said on social media 12 years ago, and they decide to cancel me now? And then, boom, my meaning in life has been ruined. You realize if you put your meaning in life in this world, that something like a storm, by the way, could destroy. Do you realize how fragile it is? And how heartbroken you're going to be because suffering is going to end up taking your meaning in life away from you. This is the acid test for the skeptical worldview of trying to find meaning, that suffering will happen. It's inevitable for everybody. And when it comes, it's gonna attack the thing that you found meaning in. Now, by way of contrast, what does the Bible offer? You look back at our origins, and you see in the Bible that we're made in God's image. It's interesting when you look at Genesis chapter 1, and you see how God creates man and what he's made for and everything like this. That it says in Genesis chapter 1 that God made man in his own image. Anybody, have you guys ever done any word searches to see where else that Hebrew word for image is used? Anybody ever done that before? Do that. It's an interesting thing. I think it's Numbers 33, Deuteronomy somewhere. There's some Ezekiel passages I know. That same word for image is used for the false gods that the Israelites were supposed to destroy in the Promised Land. Like when God says, when you enter the land, destroy the idols, that's the same word, image, like the carved images, it's the same thing. So here's one thing that's interesting to consider here. When God made mankind, he doesn't want anybody making images of him, because let's say that I make an image of God and I picture God as like a big bull. What is a big bull emphasizing about God with the horns and everything? Strength. Does that say the whole picture about God, though? Is God just strength? He's also tender and loving, and he's a father, and he's a shepherd. There's a lot of imagery. So, like, if you're going to try to make a painting or a sculpture or something of God, you're only getting a snapshot of who he is. And it doesn't say the whole picture. God made something, though, that can adequately image him. What is it? A human being that has feelings and emotions and can change the way that they feel about things depending on the circumstances, and there can be righteous anger and there can be love. God designated every human being to be an imager of him. Of all the things he made, we are the most royal. And so the Bible, the biblical worldview, does it give you a robust sense of why you're here? You were made to image the divine God. But it's not just that. Whatever you do counts forever. When you try to reach people with the gospel or you do a good deed, nobody else knows about it. The Father sees all these things. By the way, if the acid test for meaning is suffering, look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 20 and 21. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. Does the Bible teach that when you suffer, it drives you further away from your purpose and meaning, or deeper into it? It drives you deeper into your meaning. And so the Christian worldview is kind of inoculated from the suffering that the skeptic would suffer from. That's the first thing, is meaning. Now, when I study this with the skeptics, we expand a lot more on all these things. This is just a snapshot. The next need that we have is identity. What is identity? Identity, all of us have different hats that we wear. So, like, I'm a preacher, and I'm a father, and I'm a husband, and I'm a son, and I'm a brother, all these different sorts of things. Depending on what hat I'm wearing in the moment, I'm gonna act a little different. That doesn't mean I'm being hypocritical. It just means that I'm trying to fit the role that I'm in at the moment. Your identity is what's identical about you in all the hats that you wear. It's like the core thing that's true about you. And so there's a couple different approaches to understanding identity. There's the traditional approach, and there's the modern approach. Here's the traditional approach, is you work from the outside in. Let's say that I lived in the 1500s, and Daddy was a, what's a common job that Daddy would have had? Help me out. Shoemaker. So he was a shoemaker or a farmer. If Daddy was a shoemaker, what am I supposed to be? I'm supposed to be a shoemaker. Well, what if I want to be a painter? Too bad. And so the traditional approach to understanding my identity and who I am is what everybody expects of you. And if you don't like it, you've got to stuff it and just learn to be okay with it. All right, that's the traditional approach. And by the way, I'm not trying to defend any of these approaches right now. I'm contrasting this with the biblical worldview. The modern approach is the exact opposite, where you work from the inside out, where you say, well, this is who I think I am, and you all better celebrate it. And if you don't, then we're going to try to do everything in our power to make you bow down to what I want to be. It's the exact opposite. By the way, Frozen, the very theologically deep movie, 2013 is when it came out. Is that 8 years ago now? The Frozen song, Let It Go, talks about both the modern and the traditional approach to identity. Have you guys ever noticed this before? All right, check this out. Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. What is Elsa struggling with? Yeah, there's things about me that are true, and I've got to conceal it. I got to make sure that they don't know about these things. But then the song switches, and like, doesn't her hair change, and like she gets a different, like all this kind of stuff. And so the most joyous part of it is when she accepts the modern approach, and then she says, well, now they know, so let it go, let it go. Can't hold it back anymore, let it go, turn away and slam the door, I don't care what they're going to say. Do you know what it means in the song to let it go? Mom, all these things that were true about me that I was scared that everybody else would know, I just don't care anymore, and I'm going to make everybody accept it. Now, if you like the song, whatever. But there is some poison in that song. Okay, so this is the society we live in, is this modern approach. Now, what is wrong with this approach to finding meaning? One idea is that it's very self-contradictory. So, if society's saying, you be who you think you are, does anybody ever struggle to understand who you are? Like, imagine for a moment that I want to have a really, really high-paying job, and I want to move to New York City. But at the same time, I want to have, like, a wife and kids, and I want to be a good family man. And, like, I've got both desires. Is it going to be pretty hard to fulfill both of them? And furthermore, couldn't my desires sort of change every 3 or 4 months? You know that military recruiters, they call you every 3 months. Do you know why? Because on average, they find that some major-ish thing happens in your life every 3 months, major or minor, where you might change your mind about wanting to join the military. And so do you suppose that things change in our life quite often about what we would like to do, who I think I am, all this? So it's really not very a reliable way to figure out my identity. Another problem with it, though, is that it's really an illusion. Okay, so if people in our society are saying, well, you got to be who you are, you got to be true to yourself, and I say, I am a Christian, and I want to be true to my Christian identity, will everybody go, oh, wow, you're so brave for being true to yourself? It's an illusion. Because when our society says that you got to be true to yourself, it's you got to be true to yourself in these particular ways. So it's really just kind of like the traditional approach, where everybody's kind of expecting certain things of you. However it's packaged, it's really kind of a lie. All right, so here's the question then. What is it that Christianity offers? How do I understand who I am? The most succinct passage in the Bible probably for this, 1 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4, it's going to be on the PowerPoint in just a second, but let me give you the context. In 1 Corinthians 1 through 4, what's the debate in Corinth? What was that? Division over what? Who they follow, who their favorite preachers are. It goes beyond just my preference. It goes like, I'm actually going to divide over who I really like to hear preach and all this different sort of thing. And so what Paul is doing in these first four chapters is he's helping the church understand how they should view themselves, how they should view preachers. And so there's a lot of stuff about psychology in these first four chapters. Look at part of what Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4. But with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. So in this text, he says, on the one hand, it's a small thing that I would be judged by you. In other words, what the traditional approach, what everybody expects of me, I don't care. It's a very small thing. And so you might expect him to say, okay, Paul, you don't care what other people think about you. You only care what you think about you. Does he say that? No. He says in this text, I'm not aware of anything against myself. In other words, what he's saying there is my conscience hasn't been harming me. Like, I'm not, if there's some glaring thing that I need to repent of, I'm not aware of it right now. But does that mean that he's going to be okay for sure? Can he just totally rely on his conscience either? No, because that could be misguided. So he says here, I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what I think about me. What does he care about? What the Lord thinks about him. My sermon tomorrow is going to be about what God thinks about you. So I'm not going to say much about this right now. But the big idea here is that if I can be praised by the Creator, why do I care what other people think about me, and why do I care what I think about me? I'll say more about that tomorrow. Okay, the third need is our need for morality. Everybody believes in some kind of moral absolute. So, like, I like vanilla ice cream with Snickers or Heath or something like that. And none of you should say, that's wrong! You should like chocolate! There's preferences, right? But when it comes to morality, there are things that everybody thinks is equally wrong for everybody, like racism, right? That's not, like, my favorite flavor. That's, like, everybody kind of believes that that's wrong to engage in those kinds of things. And so the question is, if a skeptic and an atheist, if they've got things that they think are moral obligations, by the way, do they have moral obligations? Do atheists have a sense of moral obligation? Can atheists and skeptics do morally good things? Yes, they can. That's not trying to argue against that kind of thing. You might debate the motive that they have, whatever, but can they do morally good actions? Absolutely they can. So the question for the skeptics is, what is the basis for your morality? Why are you concerned with morality? Where does morality come from? The skeptics and the atheists, what they're going to say about this is that morality comes from evolution. That you can kind of see this in the animal kingdoms, where there's some kind of animals that take care of other animals, and like there's, you know, mother bear will take care of, protect the cubs and all this kind of stuff. And as evolution kind of continued on, it created this greater sense of morality. You also see a lot of animals killing each other. Praying mantises, man, not good. They eat their own kids. But they think that that kind of progressed to that point. All right, so what's the problem with this? One problem with this is that naturalistic evolution teaches the strong eating the weak, right? So how can you have a worldview that talks about the strong eating the weak, creating utopia, creating morality? You can't get that from it. By the way, whenever I said earlier that the skeptic has to believe things by faith, this is my favorite example. When I'm talking to a skeptic or an atheist, to ask them, okay, you care about equal human rights. That's great. I'm glad that you do. I think everybody should. But do you realize that your worldview does not support equal human rights? In fact, you go read Charles Darwin. You read his book called The Descent of Man. It's his book about who to date. Do you know who he says not to date and marry? People from Africa and Australia. And he calls them, what is the term that he uses for them? Anthropomorphic apes is what he calls them. So, your worldview doesn't support equal human rights, but you believe it by faith, and so that's one problem with this. There's another problem with this. Thomas Nagel is an atheist, an atheistic writer. He used to be an NYU professor, and he wrote a book called Mind and Cosmos. And in the book, he's arguing, he's a philosopher. And so what philosophers oftentimes do is they're sort of like a watchdog for the scientists, so that the scientists don't get so crazy with the things that they're doing. So they're kind of like the prophets to the kings in the Old Testament, but the secular version. So Thomas Nagel, here's what he said is one of the problems with evolution. If evolutionary biology is a physical theory, as it is generally taken to be, then it cannot account for the appearance of consciousness and of other phenomena that are not physically reducible. Do you see what he's saying here? When you learn about Darwinian evolution, what they're teaching and what the theory is that it's all chemicals. There's no spirit, there's no soul. Everything can be boiled down to some chemical in your brain. And you take that so far and you have to become a determinist, that we don't really have free will and all this kind of stuff. But here, Thomas Nagel, his argument is, okay, if evolution is this physical thing and it's created what we have right now, Why do we have consciousness? It sure doesn't seem like a physical thing. It seems like an immaterial thing. What about value judgments? Like, that's good and that's bad. Are those physical things somewhere in my head? How come societies across the world have kind of these value judgments as well? It seems like there's something beyond just the physical. So that's a good argument against morality coming from naturalistic evolution. It doesn't really flow from it. Here's another argument people have for morality, is that morality comes from social consensus. This is different from social contract theory. Social contract theory is a theory. It's never been done before. It states that everybody starts with a true desire to help each other, and so no society's actually done it before. But there's other people that'll take a step back, and they'll say that morality comes from social consensus. What's the obvious example of why that's wrong? Not everyone agrees. You've got Nazi Germany. That works for social consensus, not social contract theory. It's two different things. If you have more questions about that, talk to me after class. All right, so what is the basis for Christians being concerned with morality? By the way, if I'm talking with a skeptic and I say, hey, Christianity has better resources for being moral, what do you think some skeptics are going to say about that? You think you're better than everybody else, or then why are you guys so immoral? Like, you talk about like these resources that you have for being more moral. My argument is not that all Christians are going to be more moral. My argument is that Christianity has better resources to care about morality. And the best people I've ever known are Christians. Some of the worst have also allegedly been Christians. But by and large, the best people I've ever known are Christians. So we've got better resources that give us a sense of why we should care about morality. What is that for the Christian? Here's one thing to consider. All right, here's the clickatizer. So I've got the clickatizer. Let's say that I got some nails that I need to nail down on my deck or something like this, and I take the clickatizer and I go start hitting the nails, and then this thing shatters. So I contact Logi, whatever this company is. And I get to talk to the person on the phone. I say, you guys make terrible hammers. They're like, what are you talking about? The clickatizer is a clickatizer. It's not a hammertizer. And they're like, what did you try doing with it? And I tell them what I tried doing with it. And they're like, yeah, that's not the design of it. The idea being that if you don't even know why you're here, you don't even know your purpose, how can you make a judgment on who's good and who's bad? You don't even have the right to determine who's good and who's bad if you don't even have an objective sense of morality. So Christianity has a very obvious sense of what our purpose is. The purpose of man, again, is that we're made in God's image. And once again, that means that morality flows from God's character, that we are holy because God is holy. We seek to imitate his character. The things that are good and the things that are bad come from an imitation of who he is. So we've got our grounding for morality, and our feet are not firmly planted in midair like they would be in the secular approach. So that's the discussion on morality. There's always a lot more to say about every one of these. But the last need that we have for our purposes this morning or this afternoon is hope. All of us live our present in anticipation of what we expect in the future. And you think about our society. Do you think our society does a good job of instilling hope or a bad job of instilling hope? Do we do the thumbs up or the thumbs down? What do you think, Caesar? That's what Caesars used to do for executing people. Yeah, big thumbs down. That was funny. Come on, guys. What's some evidence that our society is doing a bad job of instilling hope? Yeah, suicide rates have been going up more and more. What else? Birth rates are going down, by the way. Every society that has birth rates going down is usually connected to a lack of hope about the future. Any other ones? What about all the dystopian movies and stuff that have come out over the last, like, 8 years or so? Like, Divergent and Hunger Games and all these things. Like, it's just like, even in our art, it's all, like, very bad and negative and all this kind of stuff. Okay, so what is the secular approach to finding hope? Because atheists and skeptics will have an approach to it. Here's one of them. They'll say, my hope is that I'm going to leave the world a better place. That even though everything's going to be destroyed one day, I hope that I can leave some like lasting impression. Like maybe I'll do something about global warming. Maybe I'll do something about social justice. Maybe I'll do something about whatever it is. And certainly there's been people that have done things that maybe have helped people and all this kind of stuff. But one problem with that is Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 15, where it says, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. What this means is that there's things in this broken world that we live in that that nothing will ever fix. That this world is the way that it is, and one of the reasons in Ecclesiastes 3:1-15, have you ever thought about that passage? There's a time for this, there's a time for that. That text is not saying we should do this, we should do that. It's saying that circumstances change so much that sometimes you got to cry, and sometimes you got to laugh, and sometimes you got to love, and sometimes you got to hate. They're not commands to do this or that. It's saying the point of the text is that life is not controlled by us. That it's like waves that keep crashing in on us. And God has allowed the world to be this way to teach us to yearn for what? That's the same text where it says eternity was set in our hearts. So that we're never fully comfortable in this world, and so that we never find paradise. I was studying with an atheist a couple months ago now, and he was saying that he thinks science is going to get us to a point where it totally eliminates suffering altogether. You're in for a lot of frustrations. That's never going to happen. There are things that are crooked that will never be made straight. So some people will say, well, you know, we think capitalism is going to be the answer to everything that we need. And it's capital. What's capital? Wealth and physical things, right? Should the Christian be a materialist like that? But then other people say, well, no, it's going to be Marxism. It's going to be socialism. Well, has that ever worked? You know, so like people have all these debates about this versus that versus this. And we live in a world that no matter how much you try to advocate for anything politically or whatnot, it's never going to fix the deepest problem. So your desire to try to leave the world a better place or all these different sorts of things, it's not going to go so far. By the way, one criticism of this as well. Imagine for a moment that you were on an airplane and it was going to crash in 15 minutes. It was kind of like, you know, like the slow kind of whatever. And you got 7 minutes left. You're like, well, I got to go to the bathroom. So you go to the bathroom in the plane, and you open up the bathroom door, and the light's not working. And you go to the flight attendant person. You go, the light's not working. We got to make this plane a better place. What's the criticism? It's going to crash. Why do you care about the light? Why do you care about this political system? Why do you care about making sure that this thing gets better? You believe that all this is going to crash and burn anyways. What's the point? There's another problem with this. There's another approach that people have to trying to find hope in a secular worldview. And that's to accept death as a natural part of life. I just recently read a book by an atheist woman. And in the book, she's trying to argue, like, here's how I try to find meaning and hope without God. And like it was like the climax of the book where she talked about hope and how I find hope without God. She was a good writer. She's a good writer. But this last part was just kind of sad because the book ended with her having a discussion with her like 8-year-old about what happens when you die. And she was trying to figure out how do I talk to my daughter and stuff. And the thing that she landed on was, well, when you die, do you know what could happen to your body? It could help nourish an oak tree. And that oak tree might one day have a swing hanging from it where other kids can play on it. Isn't that profound? This is The Lion King. Remember when young Mufasa, or young Simba's talking to Daddy Simba, and Daddy Simba says, we must respect all life. And then what does young Simba say? But Daddy, what about the antelope? Don't we eat the antelope? Do you remember his response? Yes, son, we do. We do eat the antelope. But when we die, then we go into the ground and then we nourish plants that the antelope then go and eat. So it's the circle of life and that song and all that kind of stuff. You see how deep Disney is. So for people to say, well, okay, here's my hope. I accept death as a natural part of life. And maybe one day I'll be able to nourish a plant and that plant will make kids happy and all this different sort of thing. If you really tried to say that and convince yourself of it, how satisfying would that be? Like, would you be okay telling a 5-year-old, oh yeah, when you die, that's it, and then you might become a tree? Go and be happy. Here's the biblical worldview. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 and 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a cry of command, with the voice of an archangel, and with the sound of the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, so we will always be with the Lord. All right, notice this. In Buddhism or pantheism, when you die, what happens to you? Anybody taken any comparative world religions classes in college? What happens if you're a Buddhist or a pantheist? You know the Avatar movie with the blue people and like terrible people are destroying the planet and all this kind of stuff? Like that's kind of the message of the movie. What happens when you die in a pantheistic or a Buddhist worldview? That would be a reincarnation. You become part of the universe, and maybe sometimes reincarnated into another. But the idea of like Buddhism is that the imagery that Buddhists use is that you're like a drop going back into the ocean, which implies what about your afterlife? You lose your sense of personality. You lose a sense of who you are because you're kind of absorbed back into a bigger thing, and you lose you. This text says the dead in Christ. And then it says, they will rise to meet him in the air. So the biblical worldview about the afterlife is that you still get to be you, but you get to be you perfected. You're not a dewdrop going back into the ocean or whatever. And in addition to that, it says that in verse 17, you get to be with them. Departed saints. Reunion. But the biggest thing about this in verse 17 is that you get to be with the Lord. You will always be with the Lord. How is the Lord described in the Bible? He's the good shepherd. He's the God of all comfort. He's the refuge for the oppressed. He's the perfect father. He's the God of peace. He's the God of grace. He's the redeemer. All these different things that the Bible says about him, that you get to be with him forever. What we want after we die is not just consciousness. Because everybody's going to have consciousness after we die. What we want after we die is love after death. The sun emanates all the light that we have in this, except for the artificial ones, whatever. But the sun is the source of light. What is the source of love? Who is the source of love? God. He emanates love. Do you want to be with that when you die? If you go to hell, you're going to have consciousness in hell. We want to be loved after death. And no other worldview teaches this kind of thing. Now, after I go through and we have these discussions, and sometimes I'll add another thing that we all know that we need and stuff like this. The most recent study I had with some of the skeptics, we ended by talking about hope, and now we're going to shift and talk about more of the objective reasons to believe in God and things like this. My goal in these first five discussions is to get them to want Christianity to be true. And if they look at it as a fairy tale, like a beautiful fairy tale, they're in a pretty good place because now their heart is going to be more in tune to listening to the evidences for God, for the Bible, things like that. Do you need to, if you want to help people understand the folly of the secular worldview, do you need to go read a bunch of skeptics and atheists to do that? No, you don't. You know what you could do? Is you got some friend in school or a family member, and you could say, hey, have you really thought about your meaning in life? Have you ever thought about how weak it is? Because we live in a fragile world. Where do you get your sense of identity from? Why do you care about morality when your worldview doesn't really... You can just point out the logical fallacies of it and show them by contrast that the Bible has everything you're looking for. So the things that you have a bad taste in your mouth about Christianity or whatever, have those discussions and try to work through those things. In the Gospel of Mark, there's a theme in the Gospel of Mark where there's the crowds. In Mark chapter 2, there's these crowds that are blocking the way for the paralytic guy that needs to be healed. In Mark chapter 6, there's the woman that had been bleeding for 12 years, and she had to work past the crowd to get to Jesus and reach him by faith and all this kind of stuff. There's other stories like this in the Gospel of Mark. You know what everybody, what faith does? It looks past the crowd and it sees Jesus. Do you suppose that there's anybody here that's struggling to look past the crowd being the hypocritical Christians, the Christians that have hurt you in some way or whatever? Do you know what faith does? It looks past the crowd, it works through the crowd, and says, Jesus is the thing that meets all the things that I need. And when I have him, maybe I can start to help these other people. Maybe I can be more servant-minded because of what he's done for me. You compare Christianity to any other worldview, we've got the resources. Are we making the best use of them? Have we fully digested this and put this into our heart? We're about to sing the song, The Great Physician. The imagery in the scriptures of Jesus being the physician, that he's the one who can heal our deepest needs. He's the one that fixes our deepest wounds. I'll say more about that tomorrow morning in my lesson. If there's anybody here this afternoon that needs the physician to heal you or that needs encouragement, you can come forward, or please don't leave either right now or the social event without having a real discussion with somebody about some of the things that you're struggling with. If there's anybody that has any needs, you can come forward while we stand and while we sing this song.
He speaks the drooping heart to cheer. Oh, hear the voice of Jesus.